is Thursday, November 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Myanmar's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi says she will be above the president if the National League for Democracy wins Sunday's election.
There is a tremendous animosity towards Aung San Suu Kyi by the old generals, and this goes back many decades.
We look at the brutality of the Islamic State in Afghanistan. And Canadian singer Alanis Morissette reissues her groundbreaking CD called Jagged Little Pill. It's all ahead. In Myanmar, opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi says if her party wins elections this weekend, she will take a post above the president in order to skirt a ban on her holding the office. Aung San Suu Kyi held a news conference early Thursday in which she announced her plan but did not elaborate.
I've not said we're going to win. I've said if we are win and the NLD forms a government, I will be above the president. It's a very simple message.
Aung San Suu Kyi is banned from holding the office by a constitutional provision that says candidates with foreign-born spouses and or offspring cannot be president. Her late husband and two sons are British citizens. I spoke with VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman, who's in Yangon, Myanmar's largest city. By doing this, could this pose some sort of a constitutional question?
Well, there could be, because if you strictly interpret the Constitution in Myanmar, no one can be above the president. However, there is some precedent for it. Maybe she's thinking about Sonia Gandhi in India, who is head of the Congress Party, did not become a prime minister. She was foreign-born Italian, and she had Manmohan Singh in as prime minister, but everybody knew that when Manmohan Singh was prime minister, it was really Sonia Gandhi that was running Congress Party and India.
And it seems like this ban, even though I'm assuming that she's not mentioned in this, but it seems like it was very clearly planned as a way of preventing her from taking the top office.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. There is a tremendous animosity towards Aung San Suu Kyi by the old generals, and this goes back many decades. A lot of people say it's probably because she was married to a Briton, and of course Briton was a colonial overseer of Burma, and there are those who still resent that. So among that generation and those types, she is seen as someone who in some ways betrayed her country. But with much of the electorate, of course, she is enormously popular, almost revered like some sort of semi-deity, and a lot of feeling that she can really do no wrong.
Yeah, and it should be noted her late father was actually the founder of modern Burma, also known as Myanmar.
Right, right, exactly. So there's that legacy as well, but she has really built up over many decades quite a positive reputation with much of the electorate. Here, of course, in 1990, her party, the National League for Democracy, won, but she was prevented, despite that resounding victory, from basically taking over the government and was put under house arrest on and off for many, many years.
Now, what kind of allegations of irregularities are there before Sunday's vote?
Well, you've got a potential electorate that's been disenfranchised for various reasons. Obviously, there's going to be a number of allegations between now and Election Day with ballot stuffing. There were a lot of problems at overseas embassies where most of the Myanmar citizens found out that they were not eligible to vote or couldn't get the right ballots. In some parts of the country, much more than in the 1990 election, elections are not being held. Polling stations are closed, presumably, according to the government, because the conditions are just too restive there with the violence and these ethnic insurgent groups. It doesn't make it possible to hold elections. There's also a lot of concern about what will happen on military bases and the observers. We've talked to the international observers, such as from the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States, say that they've been assured that they can go to all the polling places, and they said if they're not allowed on a military base or some other polling station, then they're definitely going to raise that issue publicly as well. But they're saying it's vast improvement, that they're expecting unprecedented access, and things have changed for the better. But no one, I think, is expecting this to be a perfect election.
And finally, what is the mood like in Myanmar as the election approaches?
Well, people are very upbeat. It's festive. We were just out at a NLD rally down the street from our hotel, and people were standing around listening to the speaker, and some musicians performed, and people sang. And at least here in Yangon, the largest city in the country, it is quite calm and upbeat. There's some anxiety among the voters. A lot of the NLD supporters are worried about a repeat of 1990, obviously, concerned that even if there is a big victory for their party, that the military or others may try to do something to upset that and cause more trouble. So upbeat, but definitely some anxiety.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Steve, for speaking with me today.
You're welcome, Sarah.
That's VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman in Yangon, Myanmar. Well, with what's trending on social media today concerning Myanmar is my colleague Susan Yaki.
Hi, everyone. Asian correspondent writes, Burma's gradual transition away from military rule will take an important step forward on November 8th with the country's most significant election for decades. And at this historic juncture, the nation's ethnic minorities have a unique opportunity to gain greater influence over the country's future progress. Lindsay Murdoch on The Age says Myanmar's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has declared the campaigning ahead of Sunday's watershed elections to be less than totally free and fair, and accused authorities of failing to investigate many violations of electoral laws. But Ms. Suu Kyi vowed on Thursday to run a multi-party government of national reconciliation if her party wins the country's first popular vote in 25 years, despite being barred from the presidency. Ingeborg Moa tweets, Myanmar 2010, no international election observers permitted. 2015, more than 1,000 international election observers from more than 30 countries. Amar Minthu tweets, what we need is a healthy dose of skepticism, and all this over-optimism is not helping to reform. SB at Samwe Bachawe tweets, why do you think because your father was president you have a God-given birthright to be leader of a country? Aung San Suu Kyi on my mind.
Well, Susan, what else is trending?
Well, tonight is bonfire night, when the British mark the arrest of Guy Fawkes for a plot to blow up the House of Lords. Visit London tweets, happy 5th November. Don't miss the spectacular firework around London. A little plug there. Buten says, have a wonderful bonfire night, everybody. Be sure to wrap up warm and stay safe. Suffolk Fire and Rescue warns, remember, remember, never go near a firework that has been lit, even if it hasn't gone off. It could still explode. Ben Cameron tweets, please remember to check for hedgehogs in your bonfire before lighting them. That would be horrible. And for more, go to hashtag bonfire night. There are pictures and information about events and even some recipes for this special occasion. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That is Susan Yaki. In other news, militants claiming to belong to the so-called Islamic State group have recently wrested control from the Taliban in certain areas of eastern Afghanistan. Locals say the brutality shown by this new bunch is unprecedented. VOA's Aisha Tanzim traveled to Nangarhar province to talk to some of the victims.
He carries this passport-sized picture with him in memory of his dead son. Militants from the so-called Islamic State group killed the 15-year-old boy.
My son went to get wood from the mountain on his donkey to sell. He was very young, only 15. They fired 3 bullets in his chest. His name was Khalid.
Hundreds of others in eastern Afghanistan have been killed, beheaded, or sometimes blown up with explosives by the violent group. Victims include tribal elders, members of security forces, anyone who opposes the group, and sometimes just random civilians. This man is an eyewitness to some of that violence and was almost beheaded himself. He is still afraid to reveal his identity. IS accused him of being in border police. They took him away and made him wear an orange jumpsuit. As they got ready to behead him, locals intervened.
Locals, old people, old women intervened. They said to IS fighters, he is a kid. Why are you beheading him? they let me go. They killed the others who were there. Some they blew up, others they beheaded, and some they shot with guns. Allah saved me.
This video, uploaded by IS, shows the group blowing up 10 men, some of them old. All belonged to the local Shinwari tribe. Such violence has forced many to flee their homes.
This family is living in this tent because they had to leave their home and run away. They've experienced the violence of the so-called Islamic State firsthand. A member of their family was beheaded.
After the beheading, IS refused to return the body until the family paid for it.
They were trying to sell even the dead body. They never gave his body back.
Then IS found another way to get the family's money. They captured the dead man's father and threatened to behead him as well. The family paid up and fled the area. The group's brutality is worse than anything people in these areas have experienced before. Compared to them, locals say, Taliban seem almost tame. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Nangarhar Province, Afghanistan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's been long known that evolution has guided human development to adapt to changing environments over the years. Now, new findings by U.S. and French researchers suggest that our language abilities have also adapted to our local environment. The researchers examined languages spoken throughout today's world and compared their sound structures with climatic and ecological factors. Ian Madison from the University of New Mexico says that he and his colleagues found that the number of distinct consonants in a language and how they are grouped together are related to the precipitation, temperature, tree cover, and elevation of an area in which the language evolved. The researchers say their findings support a theory which suggests animal species adjust the sounds they make so that they can be transmitted more efficiently in the environment they live in. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Alanis Morissette reissues one of her most popular albums. More than two decades ago, Philippine officials ordered the U.S. Navy to close its largest overseas base. Filipinos resented the specter of American colonization at Subic Bay and had tired of servicemen causing trouble in hostess bars just off the base. But now the U.S. Navy is back and local people welcome the return of military personnel. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA from Subic Bay on what sparked the changes.
For more than a year now, U.S. military personnel have returned to visit their former base at Subic Bay in the Philippines. But it's not like the post-World War II years. Now the Armed Forces of the Philippines is in charge of the strategic port and wants American help in resisting China in contested waters off the West Coast. Scarborough Shoal, where the two sides were locked in standoff 3 years ago, is just 200 kilometers away. Lance Gboy, a 26-year-old driver by profession, explains why he enthusiastically welcomes Americans back.
Opinion is it's okay. The U.S. troops are here in the Philippines. It's a big help for us, especially the issue on Scarborough Shoal. Most of my clients are American guys, so I didn't have a problem.
China has sparred with the Philippines since 2012, when vessels from the two sides entered a two-month standoff at Scarborough Shoal off the Philippine west coast. A year later, Philippine President Benigno Aquino angered China by asking a UN tribunal to rule on the legal basis for Beijing's claim to most of the 3.5 million square kilometers South China Sea. Manila also claims the westernmost part of that sea, which is rich in fisheries, a mainstay of the Philippine economy, and may hold reserves of oil and natural gas. China's military ranks third in the world, vastly ahead of the Philippines. So last year, Manila signed an enhanced defense cooperation agreement with Washington, the archipelago's former colonizer and still a staunch military ally. That agreement lets the U.S. Navy use the Deepwater Bay to deliver material and personnel for annual joint military exercises. 6,000 U.S. personnel came to Subic for exercises in April. U.S. ships are also using Subic Bay as a resupply port during routine calls. When the United States ran the 679 square kilometer base, as many as 5,800 military personnel would be stationed there. The United States had colonized the Philippines from 1898 to 1946 after some three centuries of Spanish rule. Servicemen earned a poor reputation in the next-door city, Olongapo, over trouble with Philippine hostesses at as many as 60 bars. This time, the armed forces of the Philippines are inviting American personnel back as they see fit, and that arrangement has eased fears of being colonized again. Olongapo business owner Stephen Lyon says the Philippine military's control is a sweetener for turning public opinion.
I think that's what they're doing, is they're saying it's in control. The Philippines has always given the love to America. There's betrayal and issues in the past and worse.
The Navy now restricts many of its personnel to a zone that excludes the bar district, apparently a rule put in place after a U.S. Marine private first class was charged with killing a local transgender man in an Olongapo hotel room. Military visitors today frequent a high-end mall with 200 stores, including numerous name-brand American chains. People in Olongapo still expect returning U.S. personnel to stoke business for the 220,000 inhabitants. Mar Emil, a 45-year-old salesman, considered his bottom line as he peddled mobile phones along a busy highway frequented by foreign visitors.
We like Americans to come back here in Cebu because, you know, the job here and the business, that's why we like come back the American here in the base. Everybody, you know, 99%, they like American here.
Don't say something American, you're going to pull out, you kick out.
U.S. personnel will go to Subic Bay again in April 2016 for joint exercises. Ralph Jennings for VOA News, Olongapo, Philippines.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Her music defined the sound of a generation in the mid-1990s. Now, Canadian-born singer and artist Alanis Morissette has reissued her groundbreaking CD called Jagged Little Pill. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, Jagged Little Pill Collector's Edition includes 10 unreleased songs from the same era.
And I'm here to remind.
Alanis Morissette was only 19 years old when her third CD, Jagged Little Pill, exploded on the music scene in 1995. The Canadian-born singer-songwriter's first single, You Ought to Know, encapsulated many of the emotions she and other young women were feeling at the time. Morissette says that the song, which earned her the reputation of being an angry songwriter, was a reaction to a life of trying to please others, and then finally being able to express her true self.
Because You Ought to Know came out of the gate first, I think that was a label that stuck. And, you know, I'll take it as a woman and as a feminist at the time and still now. If there were to be one horrifying label that's going to be stuck onto me, I'll take angry because it's so lovely. It's such a powerful force. Not the destructive version, but the one that inspires action. I'll take it.
It's like red. Just didn't take. And who would have thought
Morissette and co-writer Glenn Ballard came up with many of the songs in Ballard's studio in Encino, California. The two would write music together, and Morissette would write the lyrics. Now 41 years old, with a husband and a young son, Alanis Morissette says that time seems like just a few days ago.
It's definitely a different lifetime, though, for me. And yet there is this thread of continuity that's remained the same since when I was 2 years old, 19 years old. Now there's this sameness.
I'm high, but I'm grounded. I'm sane, but I'm overwhelmed. I'm lost, but I'm hopeful, baby.
Jagged Little Pill earned Morissette 4 Grammy Awards and has sold more than 33 million copies. Now the singer has her own monthly podcast called Conversations with Alanis Morissette. She says the podcast, which features conversations with authors, doctors, educators, scientists, and artists, is a natural outgrowth of her life. And what about music? Well, Alanis says she has a plan for a new album, but she wants to finish her book first.
I'm always writing songs, so I have about 15 new songs, and I had promised myself for a long time to finish this book that I'm writing, so it's holding the music hostage in the sweetest way. So I'll finish this book, I'm almost done, and then the second I'm done, I'll give myself probably 2 days off, and then I'll start writing again.
Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill, the collector's edition, is available now. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced this month that it is listing the military and great green macaws as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Both bird species are endemic to Central and South America. The agency found that both species are in decline, primarily due to habitat loss, fragmentation and degradation, small population size, and poaching. Further, the existing regulatory mechanisms designed to protect these macaws are not adequate to prevent those threats from impacting them throughout their ranges. As a result, both macaws are at risk of extinction throughout their ranges. The military macaw inhabits tropical, semi-deciduous forests in Mexico and South America. Although it is a large distribution, its population, ranging from 6,000 to 13,000 adults, is highly fragmented into small, localized groups, ranging from a few pairs to approximately 100 individuals. The great green macaw occupies humid, tropical forests primarily in Central America and parts of northern South America. Its population, now ranging from 1,000 to 3,000 individuals, is in decline. The service recognizes the valuable, ongoing conservation efforts to protect these species by a number of private individuals, national and local governments, and non-governmental organizations, including the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fundación Pro Aves. These efforts include providing training to local communities to monitor populations and studying species via satellite transmitters to determine the species' home range and specific habitat. However, in spite of these notable contributions, great green and military macaw populations continue to decline. As a result of this listing, certain activities involving these two bird species will be prohibited without a permit, including import into and export out of the United States, take, defined by the Endangered Species Act as harm, harass, kill, or injure within the United States, and interstate and foreign commerce. By regulating these activities, the Endangered Species Act ensures that U.S. citizens and individuals subject to the jurisdiction of the United States do not contribute to the further decline of these species. The United States is actively engaged with conservation partners and the public in the search for improved and innovative ways to conserve and recover the imperiled military and the great green macaw and other threatened species.
That was an editorial reflecting